Today is stagflation incoming. Brace, brace, brace. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, one that is post covering finance and property news. Well, the Iran war crossed the 1 month mark this week, with hostilities in the Middle East showing few signs of easing. Iran attacked several targets in Israel and surrounding Gulf countries, while Israeli forces struck targets across Iran. Supplies of oil, helium, fertilizers, and chemicals to make medicines are locked up in the Straits of Hormuz. Separating signal from noise is especially hard at the moment, but things are going to get tough for many in the weeks and months ahead. And the risk of stagflation, where growth stalls at the same time as inflation and costs rise, are looking, well, very likely. How governments react to this and the messages they send or don't send tells us quite a lot. For example, on Tuesday, a member of the European Commission urged people to work from home, drive less, drive more slowly, and fly less. The hits in economic activity across the world could be substantial, according to the IMF. Beyond its painful human toll, the war has caused serious disruption to the economies of the most directly affected countries, including damage to their infrastructure and industries that could become long-lasting, the IMF said in a blog post this week. Large energy importers in Asia and Europe are bearing the brunt of higher fuel and input costs. And on Wednesday, we had Albo via a short TV speech implying that while everything is fine for now, and enjoy Easter, things may change later, warning Australians that the coming months may not be easy. Meanwhile, the States stepped up with a small additional GST-funded cut to oil prices to match the reduction in fuel taxes announced by the federal government previously, which are becoming visible at the bowser. Though those prices are still higher than before the crisis, of course. It's worth remembering that even if oil tankers resumed their movements, it could take 4 to 6 weeks for oil to be shipped from the Middle East, refined in Asia, shipped to Australia, and redistributed across the nation to motorists and businesses. And more than 80% of refined fuels in Australia are imported from overseas because local refining capacity was limited after 4 of the nation's 6 refineries closed since 2021. Over in the UK, Sir Keir Starmer, who, by the way, would have been giving some sort of press conference before Easter anyway, and would have been containing much of the same content without the war because there were changes in minimum wage rates and the abolition of the two-child benefit cap, which has been announced before but starting now. But it was striking to see the UK Prime Minister redeploy these announcements as part of an argument for why the UK was well placed to handle whatever the economic impacts of this conflict turns out to be. His prime ministerial address was peppered, though, with gloomy language, speaking of a coming storm, which may well be fierce. If the prime minister's message could be summarised in just one sentence, it was his admission that this will not be easy. At one point, he warned that even if the conflict ends, that does not necessarily mean the strait will reopen. And he did not bring in any emergency measures, other than a specific package of support for those who use heating oil. Any support for household energy bills will not come in until the autumn. And the Prime Minister also resisted pressure, including from the Conservatives, Reformers and the Scottish National Party and Lib Dems, to introduce emergency measures to reduce fuel prices at the pump. Interestingly, the second big call from Sir Keir was to embrace his disagreements with US President Donald Trump, while insisting that the Transatlantic Alliance remains strong in terms of security and intelligence cooperation. The Prime Minister emphasised, as he'd done several times in recent days, that this is not our war. And the third big call, which was surprisingly prominent, was to seek closer ties with the European Union. It feels increasingly like the government wants to get as close as possible to single market membership as it can from outside the EU bloc. Now, those questions about economic support, the UK-US relationship and post-Brexit ties with Europe will now be at the heart of British politics as this storm gathers pace. And then we had Trump, with a ramble through recent social media posts actually, which was confusing more than clarifying, I think, on Wednesday evening, although indicating that the military would ramp up its operation against Iran over the next 2 or 3 weeks, reiterating the need to prevent Tehran from obtaining a nuclear weapon. Speaking from the White House, Trump said Washington remained in negotiation with Iran and repeated his threat of attacking Iran's electricity infrastructure if Tehran did not accept a deal. We're going to hit them extremely hard over the next 2 to 3 weeks. We're going to bring them back to the Stone Ages, Trump said, adding that the U.S. was close to completing all of America's military objectives shortly. And he emphasized on the need to hamper Iran's nuclear capabilities, which he said represented a sinister threat to America. Trump claimed that the U.S. had decimated Iran's navy and missile strike capabilities, and that the U.S. also spurred regime change in the country. He claimed that discussions were ongoing, but did not specify whether a ceasefire was close. If there is no deal, we're going to hit each and every one of the electric generating plants very hard and probably simultaneously, Trump said. He's repeatedly threatened to attack Iran's electricity plants and had set an April 6th deadline for Iran to either accept a deal or face US aggression. It was unclear whether this deadline still stood. Iran largely denied that any talks with Washington had taken place and rejected Trump's earlier claims that it had requested a ceasefire, state media reports showed on Wednesday. And Trump reiterated his stance that the US will not take the lead in reopening the Straits of Hormuz after Iran effectively blockaded the passage with the onset of US and Israeli hostilities. And he called on the countries that depend on Hormuz to take care of that passage, and they could do it easily, and repeated his suggestion that countries either buy oil from the US or go to Hormuz and just take it. Hormuz, of course, is a key shipping channel that supplies about 20% of the world's oil consumption, with several countries in South and East Asia dependent on the channel in particular, and of course Australia too, indirectly. Trump has said earlier this week that the US would wind down its military operations in Iran over the next 2 to 3 weeks, and his comments on Wednesday signaled that this timeline will first entail a military escalation before any pullback. As a result of all this, US markets reversed course to fall by 1% or so, while Brent oil prices rallied more than 5%. Now, coming back to Australia, cracks in household budgets are getting wider, though not uniformly so. Indeed, according to the RBA's twice a year financial stability review that was out on the 19th of March, Australian households have rebuilt their mortgage buffers to withstand further interest rate increases and a prolonged conflict in the Middle East. The improved financial health of borrowers, who are on average more than a year ahead of their mortgage payments, suggests that the risks of aggregated household stress is not an impediment for the central bank to increase the cash rate to a 15-year high of 4.6%. As markets are forecasting, most Australian households and businesses have built up financial buffers, although rising cost pressures will impact some borrowers, the Reserve Bank's assistant governor said in a statement after the central bank published its semi-annual financial stability review. While the future path of interest rates is uncertain, overall this outlook would imply a slight increase in the share of households facing acute budgetary pressures, the RBA said. On average, of course, is the problem, because not all households have mortgages, and not all of those with a mortgage are doing fine. Indeed, my latest analysis shows about half of those with a mortgage have cash flow pressures, although they do continue to prioritise their mortgage repayments. Worse, 3/4 of renters have cash flow pressures, something which the RBA, from a financial stability perspective, can sort of ignore, but it is significant from a growth perspective in terms of household spending. While the report warned of escalating global risks and the vulnerability of Australia's financial system to shocks, it surmised that households had sufficient cash flows and assets to handle higher costs and the additional interest rate increases forecast by the market. The central bank's modelling forecast that borrowers experiencing a cash flow shortage would increase modestly from about 1.25% to 1.5%. As higher rates and an increase in employment would largely be offset by real wages growth. But this was based on February's forecast assumptions, and, well, frankly, things have changed since then. The Reserve Bank did say that mortgage prepayment buffers, measured by the number of months borrowers were ahead of minimum scheduled payments, had also increased for all income cohorts to their highest levels since before the pandemic. the wealthiest 25% of borrowers were about 22 months ahead on repayments compared with 20 months before the pandemic, while the poorest 25% were 10 months ahead for the first time since interest rates began increasing in 2022. On average, households were about 15 months ahead on their mortgage payments, but it's a rather myopic measure in my view. The percentage of households in negative equity has also declined to less than 1%, a meaningful lower share than before the pandemic, helped by a near 20% increase in property prices over 4 years, they said. And the RBA said that the improved cash flows were due to falling inflation and interest rates and the stage three tax cuts, which has led to a steady increase in disposable income per capita since the middle of 2024. The vast majority of borrowers continue to have sufficient income to cover their scheduled mortgage repayments and essential expenses, the Reserve Bank said. The 50 basis point increase in the cash rate since the start of the year and increases in oil and gas prices over recent weeks, stemming from the escalation of conflict in the Middle East, are not estimated to change this picture materially. Well, we'll see, I guess, about that. Reading their stability report to me was, well, like reading last year's news. It was stale at best and misleading at worse. Now, trying to get a balanced view on what is happening at the moment is quite difficult. Many of the signals are mixed. But it does seem that global oil markets, equity markets, bond markets, and the banking systems are as interconnected as ever, even in an era when globalization is fraying. For example, some UK hedge funds betting on interest rate derivatives were wiped out last week as a result of the Middle East oil inflation shock, causing a massive repricing in future interest rates around the world. The funds have been betting on interest rates going down, only to have their positions smashed when investors priced in higher inflation and rising interest rates. More broadly, the Canadian scientist Vaclav Smil noted in his enlightening book, How the World Really Works, that fossil fuels remain an integral part of making the four pillars of modern civilization: ammonia, steel, concrete, and plastic. As a result, it's clear that the global production of energy is closely correlated with economic growth. So the international economy faces the real risk of a recession or even stagflation. Now, while some argue that the 1970s oil shock was bigger, with a fourfold rise coupled later with a doubling, the scarring lasted for decades as inflation hit around 18% in the 1970s and prices and wages spun out of control. The International Energy Executive Director Fatih Birol told the National Press Club last week that this was already the worst energy shock ever, and he claimed it was worse than those twin stagflationary oil shocks of the 1970s. Oh, and the gas disruption from Russia's invasion of Ukraine in 2022. He suggested that the 11 million barrels of oil a day recently lost were worse than the 5 million barrels of 1973 and the additional 5 million barrels in 1979, making a total of 10 million barrels. Today, the global gas market has lost about 140 billion cubic meters, almost twice as much as the 75 billion cubic meters of gas lost after Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Now, while energy consumption from oil is a smaller share of the economy now than it was back in the 1970s, around 31%, down from 46% in 1973, natural gas has risen from 16% to 24% as part of the interim path towards net zero. So, standing back, there are signs for those who want to see them. For example, if Australian miners and farmers run out of fuel and can't operate at full capacity, export income will be hit. Or if higher packaging and transport costs are passed on to consumers or fuel shortages prevent food getting to the supermarket shelf, those outcomes would not only be bad for inflation, but it could even threaten social cohesion. Now, we know that Treasurer Jim Chalmers has been meeting with the Council of Financial Regulators. That comprises the RBA, the Australian Prudential Regulatory Authority, the Australian Securities and Investment Commission, and the Treasury. And in their quarterly statement, they said that the Council continued its discussion on the rapidly evolving international risk environment following its meeting with the Treasurer, Assistant Treasurer, and the Australian Competition and Consumer Commission, the ACCC, last Friday. Global financial stability risks were elevated following the escalation of conflict in the Middle East. Geopolitical risks have been the focus of the Council at the same time, and the CFR agencies were engaged with industry and closely coordinating in assessing the implications for the Australian financial system. The Council noted that while direct exposures of the Australian financial system to the Middle East were limited, a further deterioration of the geopolitical environment could heighten risks to financial stability, and it requires continued vigilance. And Council members observed that the Australian financial system has established a good degree of resilience, and it was well placed to navigate high-risk international environment. It's important, however, that banks maintain strong levels of capital and liquidity in the context of wider CFR industry efforts to strengthen crisis preparedness arrangements, they said. Oh, and the Council also noted that most borrowers in Australia were in a solid financial position and remains able to manage increases in cost pressures, though some will face challenges. And the Council agreed it would be important for lending standards to remain prudent, given the backdrop of high household indebtedness, recent strong credit growth, and reports of strong competition among lenders. Now, Chalmers said that much would depend on when the war ended and how long it took for the world economy to recover, but the economic damage to Australian households and businesses from the Middle East conflict would be felt for months and maybe even years. The scale of this unfolding global economic shock is actually a big deal because it consigns Australia to a looming period of high inflation, a weaker economy, job losses, and business insolvencies. Former Treasury Secretary Martin Parkinson told the National Press Club on Wednesday that there was a risk of stagflation. This is the grim reality that Jim Chalmers needs to think about in the context of his fifth budget, due next month. He's already been forced to intervene with emergency measures in a sort of COVID-light support approach. Chalmers said that the Australian Tax Office and banks would offer struggling small businesses hit by the oil shock temporary relief on repayments. And restrictions on fuel use for motorists and non-essential industries, either voluntary or mandatory, are probably going to be imposed after Easter, depending on what happens. That's according to energy analysts, nothing from government on that yet. It's a classic supply-side economic shock that is hurting households, farmers, miners, construction companies, airlines, petrochemical firms, and other energy-intensive manufacturers. Australian heavy industry is very heavily reliant on diesel, which is facing supply shortages. As Chief Economist Sally Auld at National Australia Bank put it, the longer the conflict drags on, the bigger the local economic consequences. Even if the conflict is resolved quickly, the impact will linger for a number of months. A return to pre-conflict oil volumes and prices will not happen rapidly, meaning that the conflict will likely have a long tail in terms of its impact on the domestic economy. And also consumers can budget for higher petrol prices for a month or two, but if the oil price spike and concerns about supply shortages linger into the middle of this year, households may start to pull back harder on their spending. Actually, so far banks are reporting spending is about 10% higher on fuel, but there's been no noticeable drop in spending on other goods and services yet. And Parkinson said, you can't just flick a switch to have oil and liquefied natural gas moving around the world again. Hence, fuel supplies in Australia are unlikely to be fully replenished to pre-war levels at any time soon. And Chalmers said that there was a global scramble underway for fuel, fertilizer, and polyvinyl chloride plastics used in construction, piping, and manufacturing. And under Energy Minister Chris Bowen's new emergency spending legislation, Export Finance Australia can use taxpayer funds to underwrite the purchase of shiploads of fuel on the international market by private companies. Meanwhile, it's true to say that businesses are already swiftly passing on higher costs in the form of surcharges for fuel, freight, and transport. And bankers say that the building materials industry is already increasing cement costs by at least 5% each week. Some farmers have stopped picking crops because the cost of oil to power tractors and urea to manufacture fertilizer is prohibitively expensive. And the dilemma for Australia is that the economy was actually already facing elevated inflation and supply constraints due to weak productivity growth for the past decade. The oil shock adds more supply weakness to an economy that has already got a pretty weak supply capacity. And of course, inflation also severely constrains the government's capacity to provide financial relief to households and businesses. The government slashed to half the fuel excise for 3 months to 26.3 cents a litre, which will only modestly add to demand for fuel at a time when the government could soon be asking motorists and non-essential industries to save fuel. Higher prices are the best solution for demand management, according to Saul Cavillock from MST Marquee. The populist move on cutting the fuel excise is absolutely contrary to that. And the RBA worry that the government will offer further counterproductive cost of living relief that prolongs the inflation fight. Actually, Parkinson said it's critical for the government to embark on a range of productivity reforms to tax and migration in the upcoming budget to help raise the living standards of Australians feeling the effects of the war. But the risks of higher interest rates, pressure on households, and damage to the economy looks like the perfect recipe for stagflation. And this is so hard to tackle at the best of times, yet alone with the government debt and spending so high. As a result, government support will need to be limited. This is absolutely not like the COVID turn it off and turn it on again period, which created a significant inflation pulse. What is currently in flight has the hallmarks of something much worse and more profound, which does beg the question, are our political leaders up to the task ahead? Well, here's a long pause. Enough said. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.